Wait a second. Wait a second. We're going to kick off. We're going to kick off properly. We need to do a proper introduction. And every time we have a proper introduction, there's a story. And we have an amazing story this week, I believe. I've never heard it. And I hear that it's called The Days in the Dance Halls. That's what they call it. No. Keep it short this time, okay? Go.
Jesus Christ. I mean, how short do you want it, like? First of all, I didn't say it was an amazing story. I said it was a story. Right?
Okay.
No, I don't know how it came to mind this week. It just I heard something and it just reminded me of it, right? But when I was a young lad, right, long before you were born, I'm not even sure your parents were born when I was going around dancing, right? But down in Wexford, it was a tough enough place now to go out looking for a woman at the weekend, you know? And there was dance halls that time, right? Big dance halls, right? And there used to be show bands playing at these dance halls. But they were a bit like the cattle marts, right? The numbers were phenomenal in the place, right? And there was two places in particular that I used to go to a good bit in my earlier days. I was 18 or 19 at this stage, probably about 19. Could even have been 20, right? I was kind of a slow developer, I was, you know? And I was a bit shy as well, right? As I'm kind of still am a bit shy, I just hide it well, you know? But anyway, there was two places in particular that were close to home that I used to go to. One was Adamstown and the other was Camrus, right? I used to go into White's Hotel and Wexford Town a bit as well. But Adamstown and Camrus were closer to me. Especially Adamstown. Adamstown's a mad place, right? I don't know how many people there used to be able to fit into it, but I'd say at least 1,000, right? So I remember being there this night anyway, right? And I'd been there a couple of times before, and I kind of felt bad about the fact that, you know, some people, I mean, the fellas had to ask the women to dance, right? The women never asked the fellas, unfortunately. I'd have been happy to lie against the wall waiting for someone to come over and ask me to dance, right? But the women never asked the men, right? So the men had to ask the boys, more like it, to ask the women to
ladies
dance.
Ladies' choice.
Oh, well, there was no ladies' choice.
Ladies' choice.
I wish there was, right? But anyway, I was conscious of the fight. I was there this night anyway, and I was watching the scene and being shy. I was just kind of just hanging back a bit and seeing what was going on, right? And I was conscious of the fact that an awful lot of girls were getting no dances, right? And kind of the more popular ones and the better looking ones seemed to be getting dances all the time. And I said, God, that's very unfair, you know.
Your spirit for social justice was alive even at that stage.
In fairness now, I mean, Your point is a fair one, right? And so I said, look, I said, I'm going to be fair now, right? So I'm going to go down and I'll start in the left-hand corner and I'll ask the girl. I mean, you're talking about at least 50 girls minimum, right? It could have been 80 lining one side of the wall, huge dance hall, right? They'd be all lining the wall and the fellas would be lining on the other side, right? And they'd be like two lines of warriors ready to go to battle, right? And then, of course, when the band would say, okay, next dance now, and then all the fellas would start crossing the floor and asking some of the women to dance, right? Now, all the fellas wouldn't cross, right? Loads of them wouldn't ask. I mean, I wasn't the only shy one that was there, right? So, anyway, I said, anyway, right, listen, I'm going to start in the left-hand corner. I'm going to ask the first girl on the left if she'll dance with me. And I'll ask everyone up along until one agrees to dance with me. So went to the one in the left-hand corner anyway. I said, are you dancing with me, you know? And she says, no, just shook her head, right? So I said, right, okay. So I went to the next one and the next one and the next one. And I kind of soon found out that because I wasn't good enough for the girl to her right, I wasn't going to be good enough for the next one. And you might find this hard to believe, right? But it's actually very easy to believe for me, right? But at least 50 girls turned me down, right?
That is just unbelievable. Of all your stories, that is really taking the biscuit.
The funny part, I mean, and the sad part about it is, it's kind of been the story of my life anyway, you know? I mean, I've probably found it difficult to kind of relate with women. But anyway, every girl along that wall that night in Adamstown turned me down. I said, you know, I tell you what, I wouldn't do much for your confidence now. Mm. But humbled, I returned with my tail between my legs to the far side, right? And I watched again, right? And I noticed then something that was very unusual, right? I noticed that some fellas were finding it very easy to get a dance. And it turned out most of them were wearing wellies. Wellingtons, right?
Dance hall.
Yeah, in a dance hall, right? And the wellies, they come up to near your knees, right? Agriculture, farming,
Wellingtons.
We know
what wellies are.
Right, okay. And as it turned out, sure, look at, I mean, it was actually the best way of getting a dance. Because it meant if you had wellies, there was a good chance you had land, right?
Maybe road front.
And listen, you know. And the women were far more interested in land than a shaggy-haired fella like me. And anyway, listen, that was one of my earlier experiences.
Well, so on a pair of wellies.
Exactly, yeah. Did you buy a pair for
the ball? No, I already had a pair at home, but I never actually brought them to a dance hall. Maybe that's where I went wrong.
Indeed, yeah.
That's it.
Our next speaker is Mr. Mick Wallace.
Madness. Madness. This is madness. We cannot fix a problem caused by capitalism with more capitalism.
They hurt the people.
I ended up at the end of a gun
on three occasions.
I'd done well to survive anyway.
Madame Deli will speak.
A union which allows fiscal rules to be broken for arms expenditure,
but not for housing or to put roofs over the heads of people.
This is evidence of police violence. Whether you're an economic migrant or you're an asylum seeker, nobody deserves to be treated like this.
And even having the net to suggest separating people from their mothers. How dare you?
They don't need us to kick them around the place.
You could say, so what?
The police in riot gear with Trump. I am ashamed to call myself a European.
The recognition of Guaido,
unelected gobshite,
is an absolute embarrassment.
Now, you did use the word gobshite, and I would reprimand you over that.
So welcome back to I Foresee Trouble. That has been another story, which tends to be now a feature of the podcast. Today's episode, we just have so much to talk about. We are still in lockdown in Brussels, but there is absolutely so much still happening here. It's Friday, the 29th of May, and it's been a busy week, I think, for everyone. There's a lot we need to go into about the recovery plan, which was presented in the plenary by the Commission President, about the biodiversity strategy that came out, farm to fork strategy. We also had this really amazing report by some fantastic activists on the public-private partnerships in the EU and the corruption in their governance. Oh, what a week. So where do we start? How was your week?
I suppose the highlight of the week was that the hairdressers in Brussels have reopened, and I know it's a huge issue for people in Ireland as well. And they're very envious that we are fortunate enough to be back in that situation, and everybody's curious as to how does it actually work. But look, it's kind of as you'd expect, social distancing, every second chair or being closed off or every second sink. They have their sanitizers, everybody has to wear masks, but then pretty much back to normal. People can get their colours and their cuts done.
Hard work had to be done.
People are just, you know, men and women. The place was jammers down there. But we were happy.
Believe it or not, right, there's actually a barber shop, right?
But you know.
across the road from my apartment in Saint-Gilles. And there was queues outside of it.
Yeah.
Every evening that I happened to observe it this week. It was mad. Yeah. Right? But people might be relieved to hear that I wasn't really perturbed about the hairdressers being closed. Even though I don't go to the barbers now, I go to a hairdresser because, I mean, I'm a bit of a woman myself.
You actually have the same hairdresser. I know that. I found this out.
No.
Damien. No, it's the hairdresser in the parliament. Everybody has them. I know, yeah. Everybody has them. But
no, well, I mean, I got my... that's only once have I got my hair cut in the parliament.
Me too. And
that was my first time there. But
you were fairly shorn.
But anyway, we have to put on the public record that Claire's hair looks really nice. She looks lovely.
I feel finally happy to show
herself in public.
Now I can start recording some videos.
She wouldn't put out any videos of her speaking
one,
in the
couldn't.
She's as busy as a bee,
dreadful.
But she wouldn't put them out because she didn't want anyone to
bad.
See her.
Too
and
bad.
Now she looks absolutely...
I don't see much difference in it. I thought it looked grand before she went to the hairdresser. But anyway, I was just making the point that given that I only get my hair cut once a year, and I got my hair cut in January this year, right? So I'm actually be okay till Christmas anyway.
No,
you know?
But it shows the importance of it. I mean, in Ireland, I know from a hairdresser's at home already contacting people now with a view to making bookings in July. It's a critically important service for so many people. And again, retail workers, usually undervalued too. And I think it's another lesson to people of who are the service providers who are important in our lives. And I tell you, they're right up there on my list.
I tell you what,
always were though.
It's gas. You're talking about having to make a booking for a hairdressing, right? That reminds me. I have this friend of he's an Italian fella from the south of Italy, right? He's called Matteo, right? A bit of a queer fella, but he's he was saying that, God, just having to make a booking for a hairdressing at home, that's not really on at all, he says, you know. He says, I used to actually like going so that I'd be there for at least an hour before they start cutting my hair.
At the chats.
Because he says, it was a great place for the gossip, he says. Yeah. Well, he's obviously big into gossip, you know. but he says, you'd find out everything that'd be going on in the village, he says, in the hairdressers. Now, it's not really that kind of an institution at home.
No.
You haven't been in women's hairdressers then?
They kind of have the hipster hairdressers though in Dublin, and you can get a beer or a coffee, and you know, yeah, kind of it's about the experience rather than just the haircut. So
maybe that'll probably be gone though now. Yeah. I reckon that will be gone, like, because there's no more magazines now or tea or all of that sort of international. Well, there wasn't, you know, when I was down there. So
it's like
I think that'll be put across.
Then,
yeah. Oh, one door in, one door out, yeah, like disinfectants and that sort of stuff. So look, it's the new normal, isn't it? Everywhere, you know. Yeah. We're just waiting for the restaurants and bars to open, so we'll fill
that's
you in.
One,
hopefully,
yeah,
not too distant future.
As you know, of course, we're doing this podcast in the middle of the European Parliament, and we have to keep a 2 meter distance between ourselves. We can't even look at each other. Basically, we have our hand sanitizer. We have to walk around with our masks. So there's very strict provisions here
it
in the really Parliament.
It really makes you think about
this.
The health workers, though, doesn't it? When we have to wear our masks so long, like there was one meeting yesterday of 3 hours, I had a mask on for 3 hours. And I really thought this was, you can hardly breathe in it. And for health workers, it just shows not only are they dealing with that hyper, but to wear those masks is some ask. But yeah, no, we have to wear them all the time, except when we're speaking. And now I see there was a notice yesterday that they're bringing in temperature checks. So we're all going to be doing temperature checks entering the building from next week, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen pictures on social media of nurses putting in 12-hour shifts, which seemingly are common enough in the trade, which is a bit mad given how hard they have to work. But the state of their face after wearing a mask for 12 hours,
it's
just desperate, like, you know.
Let's have a look at what you were doing this week. So when I was asking you how your week was, I thought you'd go straight into exhibiting all the great and hard work you've done during the week, but no. Hair comes first, and then what else happened? So, who wants to take it away?
Let's go.
Well, I had a fairly mad week. I had 10 different committees and about another half a dozen meetings. I managed to speak on 8 different occasions, all at the committee. And on Monday, I was on. I'm on 4 different committees, as I've said before. I'm on the economic committee called Econ. I'm on the foreign affairs called AFID. I'm on security and defence called CEDA, S-E-D-E, and then I'm also on environment, public health and food safety. But the Econ committee were meeting on Monday evening, and we got, the commissioner was in. We got a chance.
Commissioner Vestager.
Wasn't it? Yeah. And the state aid rules came up. Now, people, we discussed this on a programme before. I mean, the stability and growth pact, for example, that we've been giving out about a lot are one of those state rules. But the state aid rules are something that we would argue have not been kind to Ireland. And they kind of almost impose austerity on countries like Ireland, because they tie their hands behind their back a bit. You're not, like, for example, if an Irish government wanted, if it genuinely wanted to invest in social housing program in Ireland, if they wanted to spend, for talk's sake, supposing they wanted to spend 10 billion and when started to really address the scarcity of social housing in Ireland at present and deal with the housing crisis that's been with us now for 6 or 7 years, really, there's rules in place that says that if they spend that money, that it goes on their books and they're not allowed to spend more than 3% of their turnover, of their GDP. So, in actual fact, it makes it difficult for them to actually borrow money in that manner and spend it on housing. Because when a state like Ireland goes to borrow money, they can borrow money at less than 1%. In actual fact, I think the last money that they bought, they got on the financial markets, cost them less than 0.5%. But because of these rules, right, we're driven into the hands of what's called PPPs, public-private partnerships, right, which are a disaster. They are a license for investment funds to print money. Because, like, for example, in Ireland, if you take the Gorey bypass, the Inniscarty bypass that was just done recently, right? They're PPP projects. That money is costing a minimum of 15% per annum. But because we pay it back over a long period, they don't put it, they only put on the books what they're paying back each year. And the big lump sum that they borrow is not counted there and then on the books. And it's almost like they're playing tricks with the accounting, but it's costing the Irish people a fortune.
Mm.
Absolute crazy. All the school extensions and the new schools that have gone ahead in Ireland the last few years, right? Most of them are PPPs as well, where we're paying crazy money on the interest. And I mean, the Irish people end up paying it in the long term. And but anyway, because
we'll
of
talk
the,
about the PPPs on EU level as well later with this report.
Yeah,
so.
But I mean, just on the state aid rules now have been relaxed. Because of the coronavirus crisis, not so that you can start a public housing programme, but in order to allow the neoliberal governments across Europe to actually bail out the private sector.
Yeah.
You have them bailing out the airlines. You have them bailing out big industry. You couldn't make this stuff up, right? And there's been, at this stage, there's been around 2 trillion approved by the EU for member states to actually give out in the form of state aid without the rules being attached. So the rules have been thrown out the window in the short term. And the likes of the Germans and the French and the Dutch and all the real wealthy countries, right, are taking huge advantage of it. And they're pumping money out to the private sector. Some of it is loans, but an awful lot of it is grants that they'll never get back. And one of the points that I raised with Vestager on Monday night was that, in actual fact, this was a great time to make sure there was conditionalities. Any money that was allowed to be given by states, by member states, to the private sector in this form should have been, the conditions should have said that it has to meet the Paris Agreement, the conditions of the Paris Agreement. But they didn't. They recommended that they go in that direction, but there was no binding liability to do so.
Yeah.
So most of them haven't bothered. The French did a small bit, right? But generally speaking, there's been no conditions attached to what they're doing. It is an absolute disgrace.
It's not only environmentally either. I mean,
no.
You're right. It's also in terms of workers, because like, you know, you were saying about you know, Air France and the airlines and all of that. But you look at the big companies like Renault, and it'd be one thing if they were doing it to save jobs and get a stake in those companies for the future in terms of environmental stuff. But they're not in some instances. They're just doing it to let workers go as well.
Yeah, and there's been no... I mean, these companies are coming screaming, oh, we're broke, we need money, right? But in actual fact, there's nothing to stop them paying out billions next year in bonuses and dividends to their shareholders. Nothing.
Like what we saw in
2008. How in God's name can they justify that? Mm. It just doesn't make sense.
And you look at the likes of Ryanair, like who we had Michael O'Leary bragging, and this kind of, some of those issues came up at our transport committee meeting this week as well, where he was bragging to his shareholders in, you know, a week or two ago about how they had 350 unencumbered aircraft worth 7 billion, 4 billion in cash, bragging about hundreds of millions, I think, they got from the British government to help them. Their wages in Ireland were being paid for by the Irish government's COVID scheme. And yet when Irish pilots went and tried to negotiate a situation whereby by offering flexibility and so on, they could all be kept on in the downturn, Ryanair management said, no, forget about it. We want 116 job losses from pilots. And that's obviously replicated across Europe and so on. So mad stuff like...
And then besides that, in the Envy Committee, the Environment Committee, we also were discussing some important strategies that came out last week. So we had the Biodiversity Strategy for 2030 came out last week, as well as the Farm to Fork Strategy, which is about sustainable food chains. They're two kind of hallmark strategies that would be part of the European Green Deal, which was supposed to frame the whole 5 years of this commission now going forward. And they're pretty decent strategies. Now, a strategy from the EU is not binding or anything. It's just about a roadmap of legislation and other initiatives that will come forward over the next few years and during this mandate of the Commission. And but they are very important because they set out a vision, they set out targets, they set out an idea of what legislative avenues the Commission is going to propose. Because the Council and the Parliament, they only amend the legislation, but it's about the proposals, what we expect to come down the line. So in the Environment Committee, we had the Farm to Fork. We had a discussion with Commissioner Kyriakides. We can actually listen to what Mick had to say on that exchange of views. So let's have a listen.
Commissioner, with regard to the targets for pesticides and fertiliser reduction and for organic farming, will they be EU-wide or for each member state? Because there is a big difference. Secondly, you say that the more hazardous pesticides are to be reduced by 50% by 2030. If they are more hazardous, why are we not getting them out completely out of our food chain by 2030? 10 years will be a long time to be consuming hazardous pesticides. And my third question, you said that action plans of member states will be monitored to see that we don't lower the level of ambition for farm to fork in relation to CAP. But decisions are being made on CAP all the time at the moment, and not all of them are in tune with the farm to fork policy. Is there any way that you could play a guiding role to see that what's happening at CAP at the moment is compliant with farm to fork?
So that was Mick in the Environment Committee on the Farm to Fork strategy. So you can see that there's the content of the strategy. There's some very important targets, such as a 25% target by 2030 for organic farming, which is huge considering Ireland has a percentage of 1%. So 25% would be a huge step up. And then there's also important pesticide reduction targets for the risk and the hazardous substances. So you were asking about that, Mick.
Yeah, well, one of the points that I did raise with the Commissioner was, for example, you mentioned that there's targets for pesticide and fertiliser reduction, and a huge increase in organic farming that needs to come into place. And as you said, organic farming is at 1% in Ireland, and the target is to get to 25% by 2030. Now, you might say, well, how in God's name will they do that? Well, look, it's a big challenge. And obviously, it is more problematic for Ireland than for other countries. But, I mean, we've been warning the Irish government about this for years because they've been sitting on their hands for a long time. Mm. We've had successive governments that have been abysmal in dealing with the challenges of climate change.
Yeah.
So one of the questions I asked was that while these targets are being set now by the Farm to Fork strategy, are you going for, and when it comes to holding people to account, is it the EU-wide that you should be looking at? Will it be throwing everyone into the one pot and seeing are we coming out at the right numbers? Or are we going to deal with the member states one by one so that everybody meets their individual targets? Now, look, it's not rocket science that if you want this to be done properly, if you don't want to be done fairly, each member state must be held to account individually.
Mm.
Otherwise, you will have some states hiding behind others.
Yeah.
And Ireland has done that for too long.
And we see that with all the targets, really.
And we're very conscious of the fact that, sadly, when it comes to the Irish governments over the last number of years, when it's left to them to decide what to do, they don't do enough. And we'd like to see them put to the pin of their collar in order to do things right now. And we'd like the European Union to actually put more pressure on them to do the right thing.
One of the things is, and maybe I've been too nice to successive Irish governments, but one of the things I'm sure they would say is we've an incredibly powerful farming lobby, or big farming lobby, which absolutely makes sure to whip them into line to serve their interests. So, you know, it's not an area that I'm particularly involved in, but my understanding is that there was a huge sort of backlash from the farmers about this farm
huge,
to fork,
yeah.
Sort of saying, this is the most radical thing, it's going to put us all on our knees and all this nonsense, as if it was. Whereas I think we'd be saying, and from what you've told me, is it probably doesn't go far enough, but to listen to the farmers, you'd swear it was the most radical thing in the face of the earth.
Well, in defence of the farmers, what I'd like to say on that point is that we haven't heard the small farmer speaking up about this, right? He doesn't have a voice, right? We have the IFA. Mm-hmm. And if the truth be told, the IFA, and farmers at home would agree with you on this, they probably represent a maximum of about 20% of Irish farmers. They represent the big farmers.
Mm.
And if farmers think that, oh, these measures will put them on their knees, well, I would argue that 80% of Irish farmers are on their knees, mm, because things haven't been done right. And
Like, for example, the CAP money, the Common Agricultural Policy money that all farmers in Ireland depend very much on now, right? Mm. 80% of that money goes to 20% of the big farmers. Mm. Goes to that section of farmers that actually don't need the money. So, in actual fact, we haven't been taking proper care of our small farmer.
And that's
and now that if we're coming up with measures like this, right, it's important that we actually help our small farmer to get to that space and be able to move away from the use of pesticides and artificial fertilizers. But in order to do that, we have to stop giving all this easy money to the big farmer who doesn't need it.
Yeah.
The big mass producer, right? He's not the one who needs the money. It's our small farmer that needs it. And I keep telling people, and the figure is frightening, right? But Ireland has lost 140,000 family farms since 1970.
I know.
I mean, how bad a figure is that?
But yeah. It's shameful, like, that the IFA are given that sort of mantra as being the voice of farmers when you say that they actually aren't, like, and the economic status of farmers shows that that is the case. And another voice that's really silent in the issue, not just in terms of being heard, but also in terms of the financial benefits, are women in farming. And particularly now with more locally based and organic stuff, there are more women involved in horticulture and growing stuff, but the percentage that women get of the CAP funds is absolutely minuscule, and is something that we should look into a bit more as well, you know?
Yeah, and was it a hugely orchestrated and big backlash from the IFA that is part of also a European campaign? Like, there's an IFA basically in all the European countries, and in the EU it's under Copacajeca, and it's this really conservative, basically, farmers' organization, interests organized like this. And what they want to do is keep the status quo or make it even worse. They want to increase the incentives about just export agriculture, and they don't want sustainable practices to be embedded in the system. So what this strategy does, it's not even that radical. Like, we went through it, and as you pointed out to Mick, like, there's loopholes throughout it everywhere, and they're low figures even with the targets. And like it says here about this organics target, that the different starting points and differences in progress made already in member states will be taken into account. So if Ireland's on 1%, that means it's in no way even expected to reach 25%. It's going to be a complete cop-out. So there's plenty in it that's what's good about it is it's the right rhetoric and it's going in the right direction. It's not strong enough and it's not robust enough. But also it's interesting with the COVID crisis, how this has been very timely used by the right wing in the parliament as well to try and postpone this whole strategy, to say, let's not deal with this. The farmers are under pressure. Let's forget about sustainability, forget about pesticides. Let's keep things as they are. And they even sent a letter, the EPP, Fine Gael's family, political family here, they sent a letter to the commission asking for the whole strategy to be postponed. Now, the strategy, as I said, is a series of legislation. So it's really unbelievable, this shamefully hiding behind COVID as an excuse to not, and we were talking about the complete opposite of a perfect time to actually introduce sustainability and proper working conditions.
And when we had the debate on Thursday evening, in actual fact, Fine Gael and the EPP started off on the defensive, more or less saying, oh, listen, you know, the times are tough. And so they are. But that is no excuse not for us not to start doing the right thing now. And just you mentioned the fact, Damien, that it isn't quite as good as it should be, even though it's going in the right direction. One of the questions that I did ask was, for example, they said that more hazardous pesticides are to be reduced by 50% by 2030. And I asked them, well, if the pesticides are hazardous, why would we have any percentage of them going into our food chain in 10 years' time? And why is it going to take us 10 years' time to only get rid of half hazardous pesticides that are poisoning people? Come on, give us a break.
Exactly. These are aspirational targets. And if we can't even imagine over the course of a decade to get rid of the chemicals that are literally carcinogenic or poisonous or killing people, it's not very ambitious.
Yeah, and obviously a huge issue, right? And this will actually is likely to be debated out in Ireland as well. We have to set an emission reduction target by 2030. And the report that was done on this is
the climate law.
For the climate law is, in actual fact, I mean, what we're supposed to be reducing in terms of emission year on year is actually, it's not even 7%, it's actually 7.6%. And that actually comes out with 68% between now and 2030.
And that's not a Greens target, it's an actual UN emissions gap report target.
This is the target that the scientists say must be met if we're to meet the terms of the Paris Agreement. And yet, now we have, in the European Parliament, we have Fine Gael and the EPP coming out saying, oh, 55 is enough. Well, 55 is not enough, according to the scientists.
And we'll definitely go into that another podcast as well on the climate law. It's a huge piece of legislation, a really key piece that everyone's working on really hard here. There's plenty to discuss on that. Just back on the biodiversity strategy. So this is another important thing that came hand in hand with the farm to fork. A really important thing about how we actually implement proper measures to stop or and reverse the decline in biodiversity. So the whole, we have a biodiversity crisis at the moment in Ireland. It's just as bad as everywhere else in the world. We have extremely intensive agricultural practices that are eating into the natural world and our biodiversity. So there are some good measures, good percentages here. There's an interesting initiative as well about having urban greening plans. So any city that's above 20,000 inhabitants will have to produce a plan for how they green the city. So that'd be interesting about urban greening areas. And also about invasive alien species as well. We've had problems in Ireland, particularly around that. And of course, everyone's interested in Sitka spruce when we're talking about biodiversity, because the health of our forests is appalling. The absolute lack of biodiversity that these practices that we're putting forward and the initiatives that are just completely going against anything, any sort of idea to restore biodiversity. But so, yeah, a very busy time in the Environment Committee and lots more still to come as well on this. And but there's been a lot also in the LIBE Committee as well, and I'm aware of that as well. Claire, you've been working on...
Yeah, well, we had a meeting today or during the week and all day. Again, I suppose one of the main things that they were discussing was what they called a toolkit from the Council of Europe. And the Council of Europe, I suppose, is the third leg or the first leg, depending on which way you'd look at it, of the European institutions. It's made up of the governments of all of the countries. And in actual fact, it probably is the most influential one, even though the Commission is the one who initiates everything. Generally, the Council is the one. But they produced a toolkit on how rule of law and human rights should be upheld during these, I suppose, unusual times where they're somewhat curtailed. And I suppose for me, you'd read a document like that, and I think it's something that we've both found here in the Parliament. What they say on paper sounds good, and you read this report and says, yes, this is exactly what we should do. And obviously protecting human health, public health comes first. If we need to curtail civil liberties within that, they should be proportionate, time limited, and all the rest of it. And everybody should be good, and we protect the right to life, and we protect all the people in institutional care. And then we look at the reality. And you see, they're very... pick on the likes of Hungary and Poland, where there's flagrant abuses in terms of rule of law, interference with the judiciary, clampdown on the media, just appalling homophobia and elimination of LGBTI rights and so on. And they're easy targets, but they hardly ever talk about the other violations. And I mean, I got the opportunity to list a load of them. Greece, the new asylum laws in there. Malta, where we've had a number of really tragic incidents with refugees being caught in boats, and the Maltese government effectively being found out to hire private vessels to intercept refugees on rafts in order to steer them, not rescue them, but steer them back to Libya, which is 100% illegal. And we had tragic testimony reproduced in the Italian paper La Repubblica, where one of the victims of one of those stories on Easter Sunday talked about how 12 of 63 people in a raft ended up dead, some of them jumping into the sea while Maltese planes and ships stood by, and they were at sea for days. Like, complete illegality from Malta. We've had the incidents which were covered very prominently by The Guardian about pushbacks in Croatia, where young Afghani and Pakistani men were basically lined up in a row, robbed, beaten, stripped, all their possessions taken, and they were branded with crosses on their heads and laughed at. This is in Croatia, where the European Commission says that Croatia is fit to join the Schengen Agreement.
The current presidency of the Council of the European Union. So,
absolutely unbelievable. Then I was able to bring in the Spanish cases, the violations there with prisoners, with the Catalan prisoners on the one hand, also a case of a Basque prisoner who's on hunger strike, and he's on hunger strike because he was singled out for being involved in a protest of all prisoners about the COVID conditions, when EU and this toolkit that we're discussing says that states actually have an obligation to protect people in institutional care. So, I mean, I kind of posed a question, which I obviously didn't get an answer to.
Yeah, if they start, listen to it, actually. Let's play it now.
I obviously agree with a lot of the points made by Mr. Yakimopoulos. The problem I have is that it is a million miles from reality and the trampling of fundamental rights which is taking place across the Union. The flagrant breach of the Geneva Convention and asylum law by the new laws in Greece. The Maltese government arbitrarily detaining migrants on tourist ships off the coast. Croatians branding and beating migrants. You know, the toolkit talks about the core right to life and the prohibition of torture and inhuman and degrading treatment. And it makes the point that this requires a positive obligation on states to prevent disease and suffering for those in state care. So I'm wondering, in the context, first of all, of nursing homes, what the council has to say about that and the disproportionate numbers of deaths there, but also prisoners. He made the point and called for alternatives to prison during the crisis, which I agree with. But are you aware, when that was mentioned in Catalonia, for example, and that release might include some of the Catalan political prisoners, the Spanish Supreme Court issued threats immediately for a possible crime of administrative conduct against any Catalan officials who might release or detain under house arrest those Catalan leaders. Now, has the council anything to say about that? Have you anything to say about the fact that at the moment the life of a Basque political prisoner, Patxi Ruiz, lies in the balance in a hunger and thirst strike because of being singled out for his role in strikes in prisons with regard to conditions? And I'm seriously wondering how ye think that the measures are going to be time limited when the council itself has condemned Ireland, for example, for the emergency measure of the Special Supreme Court, which celebrates its 48th birthday tomorrow. Non-jury, 94% conviction rate. People can have life imprisonment on the word of a senior police officer. What sanctions or measures does the council see to make countries compliant with their requirements? What you need isn't a toolkit, but a new engine. Because if you start sanctioning some countries, you'd probably have to sanction them all.
And as I said there at the end, I mean, you know, if they started looking at all countries, none would be exempt, because I thought the one I mentioned there of the old Irish Special Criminal Court was particularly pertinent. Celebrated its 48th birthday during the week. A temporary measure.
Yeah.
There you are. And let that be a warning, which was the point that we were making. Huge conviction rate. You can be convicted on the word of a senior guard, lose your liberty forever. Mad stuff. And they get around the time limited thing by saying, actually, look, we'll renew it every year. Which is just a joke, you know. So, you know, be careful of temporary measures. If we give up our civil liberties, we'd want to be very careful. Temporary doesn't mean temporary, and we've seen that with Europe's borders. So yeah. I think there's a lot of stuff there, a lot of questions were put, and we do need to, I suppose it exposes, I suppose the limitations of the EU, that you've all these countries which regulate themselves and they all basically ignore the rules when it suits, and who calls them to account?
And even for the biggest offenders like Hungary and Poland, we're saying about the rule of law, there's so little done in that regard at all. So imagine in the case of Malta and Greece and other places.
Yep.
But another thing in the AFET committee, the foreign affairs, I hear, Mick, that the Zionists were on your back. We have a clip, I think, to play for that.
Mr. Borrell, I think you'll agree with me that there are a number of major issues that are central to peace and security in Europe. On the 4th of February, you said that in line with international law and relevant UN Security Council resolutions, the EU does not recognise Israel's sovereignty over the territories occupied since 1967. Steps towards annexation, if implemented, could not pass unchallenged. Do you stand by that statement? And what measures will the EU take to hold Israel accountable if it should proceed with further annexations of occupied territory? And would it include the suspension of the association agreement, whose validity is predicated on Israel's respect for human rights and international law? Another question, why has the EU restricted exports and imports from the Crimea, which it says is a legally annexed territory, while it continues to allow Israel to export goods from illegally annexed and occupied Palestinian and Syrian territories? Now, Mr. Borrell, We have a serious problem, and it reflects very much on Europe. The Palestine-Israeli situation is crucial to peace, not just in that region, but in Europe as well. And wouldn't it be great if we actually had a democratic state for Jews and Palestinians between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean? Right now, the two-state solution is dead. The one-state one is an apartheid state. Zionism is a colonialist project. And Minister Borrell, do you have what it takes to actually make progress in this area? Because peace would mean so much. Right now, there's no democracy there because 6 million Palestinians are being brutally treated by the Israelis. Thank you.
It got a lot of coverage. I suppose at the Foreign Affairs Committee and Security and Defence here, I'd be a bit of an odd man out. Most of the thinking is very much of the right-wing persuasion and very much they bow to America no matter how bad they behave most of the time. On this particular issue, the High Representative for Foreign Affairs, Joseph Borrell, was taking questions, and he would be the most powerful man in the Commission in relation to all this these foreign affairs matters. And I asked him, right, as you know, Israel is threatening to annex huge more portions of the West Bank from Palestine. And this is 100% contrary to international law. All the countries of Europe have said, oh, no, you shouldn't do this. Oh, this is not good enough. But they do nothing about it. And when Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, came out in February and said that, yeah, we're going to do this. And that's the plan. And he just he's now gone into government with a fellow called Gantz, who is an unlikable an operator as Netanyahu himself. But Borrell said in February that if Israel proceeded to annex more territory of the West Bank from Palestine, that the EU couldn't sit idly by, that this would be a total breach of international law, and they would have to react. So that was fine. What Borrell wasn't expecting was different members, states across Europe, weren't completely happy with what Borrell said. Borrell made a statement about 4 weeks later, and it was a watered-down version of same. About a month later again, he made another statement, which is a watered-down version again. Mm. So when he came before us on Tuesday for questioning, I asked him, listen, you said this in February. Do you stand over it? And then I asked him, and OK, if Israel does go ahead and do this, what are you going to do? And I also asked him, is there any chance that the EU-Israel have a very famous agreement that's really valuable to Israel? It's called the EU-Israel Association Agreement. I asked him, if Israel continues with its plans to annex huge territories in the West Bank, will ye suspend the association agreement? He wouldn't even answer the question. Mm. Because the association agreement, it was something that was brought in, and one of the conditions of it was that Israel would respect human rights and international law in all matters. Now, listen, you might smile, right? Because it's a bit of a joke, right? There's not many countries in the world that has such disrespect for international law and human rights as Israel has had for a number of years in how they treat the Palestinians. It is nothing short of criminal. But anyway, I also asked him, as you might remember, in 2014, when Russia annexed the Crimea, which happens to be about 90% Russian anyway, Europe suspended all trade with Russia on account of it, because they said, you have broken international law, you're occupying a territory that you shouldn't be occupying, so we're not taking your goods. So I asked him, can you explain to me why the EU has suspended trade with Russia because they annexed a territory called Crimea, and you continue to trade with Israel even though they have annexed huge portions of Palestine already? And we have in Gaza, Gaza today, it is the biggest open-air prison on the planet. Mm. You have close to 2 million people living in an open-air prison, and we still import goods from them. And if you dare talk about BDS, to boycott, divest and sanctions against Israel,
well,
you'd actually be accused
anyway.
Of being anti-Semite. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
But it shows the bullying, like. I mean, you did get, you know, there was obviously, they tried to target you. I spoke at a web event on the issue of Francis Black's bill, which touches very much on the points you're making, because even though we would support BDS, this isn't a BDS bill. It's a piece of legislation which says you should not be handling the goods which are the property of theft. And that's in compliance with international law. It would just make us really adhere to international law. And the EU should be doing it, as Mick says, like they're doing in relation to Crimea. But, I mean, it's just incredible. Now they're talking, but the part of that reflects the bullying that Borrell was put under. It's just incredible, and that's why they do it, because they can get away with it. It's not just the association agreement. Horizon 2020,
absolutely,
we give potloads of money to Israel. We've
that's
been involved in the Frontex,
the
EU's research program. We have a new one now, it's been called Horizon Europe, plans for money out of that. There's money gone in under Horizon 2020 to universities which are built on settlements. This is the proceeds of crime, and we shouldn't be doing it. That's why I think Francis Black's bill was really important. It's a bit of a beacon to other European countries, and I think the reason why the Israelis are so sort of panicked about it is that it actually, if that comes in Ireland, we'll be able to show that you can do it, and then I think other countries will follow on that, you know. It's but we have to do something, because they're lost.
You could almost say, you could arguably say that Israel is a member of the European Union with the amount of integration it has in terms of energy research. It's part of the 100 billion euro research program. It gets lots of money. We have a vote on the 17th of June in the plenary with no debate, about Euro-Mediterranean aviation agreement between the EU and Israel, where there's constantly this EU-Israel cooperation on the agenda running through.
I'm a shadow on that now. Yeah. That's a pretty harmless one. One of them is pretty harmless, but we are actually trying to get that not voted on. We don't want it voted on because of the situation.
But the thing is,
you know,
in the midst of this context of Netanyahu coming out with explicit plans to annex more, it's not even a secret in any sense, and there's still this continuous close cooperation, closer and closer, with no debate. Bring it forward, railroad it through.
The main reason that they used to attack me, the Israeli groups, after I spoke on Tuesday, they said that what I said was vile, because I said that the Zionist project was a colonialist project. Well, in actual fact, of course it is a colonialist project. You have a native indigenous people called Palestinians, and they're being, you have a settler colonial project on the part of Israel. And right now, and what I called for when I was talking to Borrell, I said, wouldn't it be brilliant, I said, you can forget about your two-state solution, I said, stop even talking about it, because it's not possible anymore, because Israel isn't going to disappear, right? So I said, you have a one-state solution at the moment, but it's a one-state apartheid state. Apartheid state, nothing short of it, right? And I said, wouldn't it be great if all the Israelis and the Palestinians could live in peace in a democracy between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean Sea, right? A one-state solution, I said, but a democratic one where human rights are respected. Whereas at the moment, we have anything but that. Mm. And that's what the international community should be working towards now. And one of the reasons that the whole subject got such attention since Tuesday was because the Electronic Intifada covered it, right? The famous writer Ali Abunama gave a great coverage, and he's pointed out that if you want to deal with what's happening in Palestine, you've got to look at what happened in South Africa. You had an apartheid state in South Africa, and the international community eventually got to his place and said, you know what, we're going to treat you like a pariah state until you learn to behave. Whereas we haven't got to that space with Israel, because that's what we have to do. We have to stop treating Israel like as if it's a normal state, because it isn't. It's an apartheid state, and it is persecuting millions and millions of Palestinians. And we in Europe, the EU is complicit by its behaviour towards Israel and Palestine.
Yeah,
because not only is it not treating them as a pariah, which it should do, but they're actually, as you say, getting special treatment.
Special
and I think people across Europe will be absolutely horrified about that. And particularly in Ireland, where there is such an affinity with the Palestinian people, I think that was just quite shocking, you know.
Let's move on to the recovery package. So this week we had a little plenary session, which is when the President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, came to the Parliament to present the recovery package for the economic crisis that is going to follow now the COVID-19 pandemic. Let's have a little listen to Emma Clancy, who's our economics genius, regular on the show now, to just give us a little update on what's in this recovery package.
I'm going to briefly outline the numbers involved in the EU's recovery plan announced this week and what impact I think it will have. Ursula von der Leyen, the Commission President, claimed that the whole package of EU spending so far, if this package is adopted, will amount to 2.4 trillion euros. This includes the first response package, the EU's long-term budget of 7 years, and the next generation fund of 750 billion euro that she announced this week. This fund would be raised through borrowing by the Commission on the financial markets, and such Commission borrowing would be a type of one-off Eurobond. The first thing to note is that we're not talking about 2.4 trillion euros. If we strip away all of the spin, the figure that we're left with is actually 310 billion euros of spending on the recovery by the EU. This isn't an insignificant sum, but it's certainly not 2.4 trillion euros, and it's certainly not enough to deal with the scale of the crisis we're facing, even if it does get the approval of all 27 member states. It amounts to just over 0.5% of EU GDP. And the Commission itself estimates that if we experience a second wave of infection this year, we're looking at an economic contraction in the EU of 16% of GDP. And to put that figure in context, at the height of the global financial crisis, the EU economy shrunk by around 4%. There are also, of course, as always with the EU, strings attached to the recovery facility, which will be embedded in the European semester, the EU's framework for surveilling and controlling member states' national budgets. So to access the money, countries will have to comply with the Commission's neoliberal reform agenda. The issuance of common bonds could, I think, be welcomed if the ECB was permitted to purchase unlimited bonds and cancel the debt or hold them in perpetuity. But the next generation plan totally fails to deal with the fundamental contradictions of the EU's economic architecture. It will add to member states' national debt and trap them in a permanent austerity spiral.
So, Claire, Mick, I didn't actually get to hear what von der Leyen had to say in the plenary session.
You. But what a loss.
I was very busy. But I did take an elevator with her, which was funny because, we happened to get into the same elevator. You're only allowed to be two in an elevator at the time, and we were three. So got a lift in her. She didn't even say hello to me, didn't even look at me, but...
Well, she shouldn't have got into the lift. Who got into? Who was the third person in the lift? Because they were breaking regulations.
Exactly, yeah, I can't.
I hope
it
wasn't you, Damien.
No, come on.
But anyway, it was me and Ursula were there, and someone else. And she wouldn't look at me, but she must have been a bit nervous before she gave her speech. But you heard the speech. What's your take of the recovery package?
We're a bit underwhelmed, I think. Well, I suppose it's a couple of things. But I mean, obviously, as Emma said, like full of much ado about nothing in some ways. A lot of hype, even the sloganeering. And she's brilliant at it. Like, you know, the sort of picture perfect hair and the little gesture, the hand gestures and the language and everything. And, you know, new generation EU, you know, we're going to be develop a new generational pact for tomorrow and all this nonsense. But when you dig deep, you know, we're talking about 750 billion on top of the 1.1 trillion budget that's already there, hasn't been agreed upon yet, but the type of budget that they would be talking about anyway. So in terms of extra money, 750 billion, they're talking about grants, loans, but really not much detail on, you know, how this is going to be paid about. They're making some noises about mutualisation. But even we could see in the discussion some of the frugal four, as they call them, which is really insulting, actually. that type of language, like making out that some countries are industrious and manage their books well, and then the rest of us are a bunch of layabouts. And actually, this has been replicated in magazines in the likes of the Netherlands and Austria, which show their people being really industrious and going to work. And it shows the Italians and the Spaniards sitting on the beaches, drinking wine and, you know, making themselves look gorgeous and all this kind of stuff. So it's that type of nonsense. So, and we could see that even in the Parliament with some delegations while saying, oh, we welcome the package, but we have to be careful, and who's going to pay them, pay this money back? And of course, that is the question. And I'd have to say the answer isn't there. There's a couple of things on it. I think for me, again, it was another example of the Irish media. They did cover this story, but on the news, they covered Mick going over to talk to Phil Hogan rather than any of the other content of the work we've been doing this week. Do you know what I mean? Rather than details.
Did you get to say your opinion of the recovery package? Did you have an interview?
He hadn't heard it at that stage. He only went at the
start. But after this, have you been contacted?
About the media? Yeah. God, yeah. No. I think this is important. I mean, we saw the statement, and the Department of Foreign Affairs circulated us with the statement straight away. Irish government welcomes 1.85 trillion recovery package. Well, that's nonsense, because 1.1 trillion is already the budget. 750 billion, 500 billion of that is grants, and 250 billion of loans. They'll go out and raise the money on the markets and wherever. And they say it's on top of 2 trillion in state aid without conditions, which the member states themselves are spending. But let's look at Ireland in that, because people in Ireland were shocked at the breakdown of that money so far. And let's hear them now. We're talking about 750 billion, and the initial breakdown has Ireland getting 1.9 billion. We're second last on the bottom, just above Malta, which has a tiny, hardly any people living there. I don't even know how many, but tiny amount anyway.
Over 350,000.
Yeah, so
Mick and I love populations. Yeah, we're always
tiny, right? And Ireland is the next lowest. Right, 1.9 billion out of 750 billion. Up against France, nearly 40 billion. Poland, the same. Germany getting a big, massive chunk, pretty much about 35 billion. And what are Germany and France and these countries doing? Well, they're putting them into Renault, they're putting them into Air France and all of that. And meanwhile, Irish workers sitting at home, Aer Lingus workers, 1,000 of them are going to lose their jobs. Cabin crew are being put down onto 30% pay, and the Irish government are doing nothing to intervene there, not to mind they're whinging about paying the 350 euros to people. And meanwhile, they're saying only 1.9 billion. And it seems that one of the reasons why we're so low on the pecking order is for the previous mistakes that they already made when they've been bleeding Irish people dry, particularly their refusal to take up the Apple money. Because the word is, well, sure, look at Lance, if you know, this has been done on a need basis. Sure, you can turn down 13 billion. If you need the money, sure, go, just take it. Stop taking that court case, take the 13 billion, and you can spend that. You know, you can spend that, and then you can have this bit as well. And sure, you're all right if you can turn down that money. Disgraceful.
What does it say about our mainstream media that they do not hold the government at home to account? What does it say about
that they allow them to put out a press statement saying they welcome this money rather than saying we've been making a holy show of ourselves again? Not to mind last time we paid the bondholders when the bondholders themselves were expecting to get burnt, laughing at us, and here we are, because of all that type of thing, we're being laughed at again, bottom of the flipping pile. And then many countries who've got a lot of money and are flagrantly breaching the rule of law are going to get potloads of money out of this as well. So it's really poor stuff. And again, the lack of serious critique, I think, is there. But there's certainly no white knight coming to the people of Ireland from this plan.
And certainly no break from neoliberalism.
No.
A lot of the talk is very vague as to what's happening.
Yeah.
They're mixing up grants and loans and guaranteeing loans. And we still don't really know how they're going to deal with the crisis from a financial point of view, the fallout of it. And we still don't really know how Ireland are going to fare out of it, even though, as Claire was pointing out, you'd be very concerned. But listen, Europe has huge decisions to make, and they haven't made them all yet, and they're scared of making them, because a lot of their decisions, they need unanimity, and they can't get it, because you have the likes of the Germans, who have plenty of money, are able to give over a trillion now with the state aid rules relaxed to their private sectors. One of the few countries that actually were able, that had a health system that could actually deal well with the coronavirus crisis, because they, despite the fact that most countries in Europe had to cut back on their health service because of austerity in one form or another, the Germans could afford not to do that, and they were better placed than anybody else. And if you look at the figures and the casualties in Germany, they're very impressive in comparison to other places, because they could afford to have a health system that could deal with it better, right? And the truth be told is, not only does Germany run the European Union, but it is run more in the interest of Germany first and the rest later. And obviously the better off countries do better out of it, and Ireland are not getting a fair deal from Europe, and that's the truth. I don't care what anyone says, if you look under the blankets and see what's going on and under the covers, there's a huge problem and a huge lack of unfairness in how things have been done. And unfortunately, we don't have a media that's prepared to go into the detail and to hold them to account.
And there is a genuine, like, there is a genuine ideological battle going on here, because the Germans a little bit have been reined in on that, because as Mick is true, they're the biggest beneficiaries, but they're sort of, no, we're not going into loans, we're not going into that. They've clawed back from that a little bit, but we haven't seen the full detail. I mean, they've been kind of at pains to say ordinary people won't be paying back, that they're going to make the big companies pay, the big winners out of this, the big digital companies. There was talk about a digital tax or this type of other taxes, but the EU doesn't have a tax-raising ability in that way. So are they talking about a member state levy tax that the monies would then go to repay this bank? It's a little bit woolly, you know, a bit aspirational. So we don't actually know, but certainly the Irish media aren't even asking the questions, not to my knowing the answers.
Yeah, just on the issue of money and at home as well, right? I actually had four econ meetings this week, committee meetings, but at one of them, Andrew McDowell was answering questions on behalf of the European Investment Bank. Andrew McDowell, he was actually, I think he was the private secretary to Enda Kenny when he was Taoiseach. But I was asking him, and there was a breakdown in communication as he was on the computer, and he has to reply by written reply to me, so I haven't got an answer yet. But the European Investment Bank were making the point that they're making a lot of money available to help small and medium-sized business, right, across Europe. But we were asking, okay, but how do you do it, right? But in actual fact, the only way they can do it, the only conduit that they can use is public or private banks, right? But you see, we don't have public banks in Ireland, unfortunately, right? We have private banks. So my question to him was, well, tell me, okay, you're saying you're going to make money available to SMEs in Ireland through the European Investment Bank, which would come cheaper than any other money, right? And I said, how in God's name, I said, are you going to make sure and guarantee that private banks in Ireland will actually make money available to small businesses in Ireland? How do you make them do it? Because the truth is they don't. Well, they haven't to date. Now, whether they're going to change their tact. And I've been making the point that while the government, well, obviously it was an instruction from Brussels, but paying the wages of people laid off or people not laid off and out of work was a good measure. And it has been significant and important, right? But what people need to remember now is that 3-month period is coming to an end where they were paying that. Now we're going to have small businesses all across Ireland opening up, and they are going to face incredible challenges in trying to keep their business going. There's going to be, the people are going to have less money in their pocket. There's going to be, unemployment is already at around 17%, right? Your tourism sector is gone for the year and probably a good part of next year, right? There's huge challenges there, and they're going to have liquidity problems. Are private banks, are the likes of AIB and Bank of Ireland, for example, at home, going to give money to small businesses that they'll think are afraid they might go out of business? I tell you what, when they do that, I said, it'll be interesting to see, because now is the time when they reopen. That's when these small businesses really need help. And we're going to lose an awful lot of them unless we give them the right help. And I'm not talking even, there should be more than just loans for them as well. There should be grants. I mean, you have, if you have the big airlines and motor companies across Europe getting help, how come we can't help small business?
Yeah.
But I think, I mean, but there's no help to the aviation sector in Ireland, and that was an issue that came up at the Transport Committee, and I was very glad that I got the chance, because there are hundreds, thousands of aviation workers in Ireland who are afraid of their life. And as Mick says, the tourist season is probably over for this year. There was a big debate on the radio led by Michael O'Leary about lifting the quarantine and targeting the quarantine as if the quarantine itself, this is the idea that when you land in Ireland or you come back from your holidays in Ireland, you've got to self-isolate for 14 days. Now, that situation has been in place anyway in Ireland. It's in place in many European countries. There is an argument to say, and we had that debate at the TRAN committee, and it shows the difficulties faced, I suppose, in every issue we discuss here, is that Member States would like to have a situation whereby it's equal, that we all do things at all the same time. But that's not necessarily always possible, and we have to have the right of countries to do their own thing as well. But I think that in terms of tourism, the word very much is that people aren't really going to be going on their holidays, and they're certainly not really going to be flying, that they're going to be maybe visiting more locally. So that's easier for people if you're in France and Italy or Spain rather than in Ireland. So we do need help. But I mean, I think what Irish aviation needs as a help is, the problem is not just the quarantine at all. Michael O'Leary was using that for his own purposes to get things up and running, to boost his profitability. But we need systems put in place where by workers can be kept on the books, pilot skills can be maintained, that skill set and so on, until things do pick up, which won't be this year, unfortunately. Yeah. It'll be next year.
Yeah. So before we wrap up, we have a few things still to talk about. That's, I know the time is running.
But realistically,
there's so much that's happened this week. We can barely cram it into the podcast.
Very quickly
so
do quick. Corporate Europe, though.
Well,
just to touch on things that maybe we'll get around to next week that I was involved in this week as well.
Just
barely touch on them without going into them. Right? One of them, there's an outrageous report from being put forward by the Green Party around arms sales, right, which is doing nothing to control arms going to the likes of the Saudis.
The Green
UAE,
group in the Parliament,
right?
Yeah.
I had a committee on medicines, right, which is really important, where they're actually proposing giving billions more to the pharmaceuticals, right?
This is on the rather than investing in medicines, right?
Rather than investing it in public research and getting taking this away from the private sector, which we need to do. And there's another report recommending now that we put a lot more money into the military campaign in the Sahel region of sub-Saharan Africa, which is absolute nonsense, while the governments are being robbed and pauperized by European companies.
Yeah, there's a lot happening here, and there's a lot the two of you are working on. But that thing on the medicines you mentioned, you spoke in the committee in Envy about the joint undertaking on the Innovative Medicines Initiative. Now, that's a big public-private partnership in the EU. It's the oldest one that the EU has with the private sector, a consortium of private firms, none other than Bayer, Pfizer, all the big ones that you can think of.
GlaxoSmithKline.
Yeah, Johnson & Johnson. They're all there and they all have their stake. So we talked a bit about the research budget of the EU. 100 billion euro is in the next phase. And there's a number of these public-private partnerships where this money is basically handed out to the private sector, that they provide in-kind payments, or don't give any cash at all. They just give a premises and some researchers. And they also then get to develop the whole agenda of the research. So we've seen that. And that most recently in this report that came through. This is a great report that's done by the Corporate Europe Observatory and Global Health Advocates. So let's just listen to some of the authors, what their main findings are of this report, and then we'll have a chat about it afterwards.
Hi, my name is Martin Pigeon, and I'm working with Corporate Europe Observatory, an NGO based in Brussels. In this recording, you will also hear my two colleagues, Marine Ejulian and Jill McArdle from the NGO Global Health Advocates, because the two organizations we work with have published last Monday two important reports that took us a lot of time, more than a year, in fact, to research and write, on two research public-private partnerships between the European Commission and industry lobby groups. The first is called the Innovative Medicines Initiative, IMI for short, and the second, the Bio-Based Industries Joint Undertaking.
With this report, we wanted to understand whether IMI meets its objectives and whether it delivers positive societal impact. What we found is not very encouraging, unfortunately. First of all, there is a heavy imbalance in IMI's funded priorities. It is investing more, in fact, in high-profit areas for the pharmaceutical industry than for so-called market failures, such as, for example, poverty-related or neglected diseases. Secondly, there's also very little evidence that IMI is making new medicines more accessible. The economic impact, on the other hand, for the benefit of the whole society is also questionable.
Several research projects give the pharma industry pretty much unmediated access to EU regulators to lobby to change the rules on the safety standards for new medicines. This is an alarming finding, as pharma clearly has a huge financial interest in getting medicines approved faster and with less evidence.
Overall, our findings show that IMI fails to meet the objectives that justify its existence. But this is not very surprising, because when you let the profit-driven industry to set the agenda, they are naturally going to work for the objectives that they are set up for, which is maximizing profits for their shareholders.
So BBI is, as I said, a public-private partnership between the agribusiness, forestry, biotechnology, chemical and fossil fuel industries, and the European Commission. And the idea is that this partnership is going to finance research that will help building a sustainable low-carbon economy, between brackets. So the idea is quite simple, is to replace oil with plants in industrial processes. So the main purpose of the BBI is to build so-called biorefineries and develop new technologies to process biomass extracted from forests and soils. So on paper, replacing oil with plants sounds like a good idea, and the BBI appears to support the European Green Deal, for example. But the research that I have done, and many others in fact have done also, is that shows that biomass production in Europe has already reached maximum capacity and in fact is achieved at the cost of unsustainable agricultural and forestry practices. So the additional demand for biomass that these industries will trigger can only be met at the expense of the food supply or the integrity of what's left of nature. So despite its green look, if you take it in its real context, the BBI is pushing false solutions. And besides, you can also see that, I mean, it's only a partnership in name, because the EU is bringing public money, cold cash, but the industry is not. They were meant to contribute in cash as well, a bit, but they've so far provided only 3% of what was expected. And so they're really getting a sweet deal for themselves.
What our reports show is that instead of doing its job by regulating business, the EU hands control of public money to industry to do whatever it wants, even including lobby regulators to weaken our health and environment rules. These partnerships set a truly disastrous precedent. What is at stake here is the corporate capture of large areas of the EU's research policy and budgets at the expense of public needs and our health and the environment.
So that's a bit of an insight into these really big and important reports in the name of innovation, how industry controls billions in EU research funding and deprioritizes the public interest. And I guess that's what it's really all about here. It's about, what are we researching? Is it for the public interest or is it for capital enterprise? And there's no doubt about it. If you look at all of the public-private partnerships, which are called joint undertakings at EU level, look at all of them, and none of them are under the public scrutiny and for public interest. They're completely directed by the big firms, and we're getting a big bad deal out of this. So.
Yeah, and just one point on it. I know we have to wrap up, but the Corporate Europe Observatory pointed out that the joint undertaking involving the Innovative Medicines Initiative, which is made up of the big pharma buys, it showed where 3 years ago they actually rejected the European Commission's proposal to work on fast-tracking vaccines for pathogens like coronavirus so that they can be developed before an outbreak. Yeah. It was deemed that it wouldn't be profitable enough. Yeah. So in other words, what you're talking about is profit is the only thing that matters to these people, and they couldn't care less about public health.
I think for me, there's two things on it. One is, and people should read the report, it's a graphic illustration of the corporate capture of the European Union and how lobbyists dominate the scene here. This was supposed to be a vehicle whereby a market shortcoming would be overcome by where a need that the market wasn't meeting, that they with areas of research that this body would do it. But instead of that happening and the areas, as Mick outlined, being dealt with, it just became a sort of a cash cow for the private sector because the way the terms and conditions of it are set up to invest in their own projects, which they would have done anyway, but they would have just paid for it themselves. And for me, the biggest thing that screamed out, for starters, the study was only into 2 out of the 7 major joint undertakings, so there's obviously a lot more. But the saddest thing for me, having done work in Ireland, was that out of that 7 out of the 25 WHO priority areas that need research, where the market isn't meeting a need to research health projects, didn't have any IMI project there. So there were 7 areas. And out of those, so they were investing in Alzheimer's, diabetes, cancer, which are very important, but which the private sector is already doing because there's a lot of money to be made in it. But some of two of the areas that they were neglecting were neonatal conditions and postpartum hemorrhage. So women who die after losing blood, after giving birth, areas that we've worked in Ireland, where sadly a whole number of women have lost their lives in our maternity services, and the money was supposed to be going into research and that, and instead it's lying in the pockets of big pharma.
Yeah, and that's what happens when we deprioritise public interest. We know in Europe more money goes into balding research rather than into rare diseases. There's plenty of examples of these twisted policies, which because of these incentives that aren't in the public interest, we don't have the right oversight. And the shocking thing, I think, from my perspective, is this isn't about corruption. It's not about mismanagement of funds. It's not about any sort of revolving doors issue. It's actually just about the governance of what we've signed up to. Mm. The European Union has signed up to these. Just recently, we've even discharged their accounts to make sure that everything's in order. But the actual governance structure of these is so corrupt that we're just giving billions of taxpayers' money to these big firms. We're not talking about little firms. We're talking about the biggest players here who have plenty of money to put in money, into research and development in their most profitable areas, whatever. But where is the public interest in this? What are we doing? We're research and public health. We're talking about people's health. Mm. We're talking about lives. We're talking about diseases. We're talking about people living in awful situations, and where we need research and technology and innovation to work for us, not for profit, and to sell us more things we don't need. So it's just quite chilling stuff. And we knew all this already. It's not new. It's just more damning with this report.
When you read it,
report.
It's even worse.
And that's just in terms of the medicines. The other one is in terms of the bio-based industry, which we don't have time to talk about now. But again, it just shows you a huge waste of money and a big bad deal that we're getting out of it. So always get in touch with us at I Foresee Trouble. We love hearing from you. We've had some great feedback, and any questions, anything you want to know about the EU, what's going on, we'll bring them up in the podcast. And that's it, really. Hope you're getting
Peter
through
Zane.
Lockdown. And
in these days of frugal
Ciao,
fours.
Ciao.
Auf Wiedersehen.
See ya.